Curse.
Welcome to Speak and Destroy. Speak and Destroy is the first podcast featuring interviews about Metallica, and I am your host, Ryan J. Downey. Before we jump into this episode, I would just like to remind you that there are two really great ways you can support this podcast. The first is to become a patron on Patreon, where you have access to bonus episodes called from my interview archives with Metallica-adjacent people like Glenn Danzig, Randy Blythe from Lamb of God, and even Kirk Hammett, who is actually in Metallica. You can also go into Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star rating and write a nice little review. Those really do help. You can find Speak and Destroy on social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. You can find Speak and Destroy on YouTube. And you can find me on Twitter at Ryan Downey and on Instagram at Superhero HQ. Speak and Destroy is part of the Pop Curse Podcast Network. Check out some of our other shows like No Prize from God, featuring conversations with creative people about belief, unbelief, and everything between, and Pop Curse, musicians talking movies. My guest this episode, Erland, is perhaps best known as the former frontman for Cavalry Attack, and now fronts his own eponymously titled band. We talk about his upbringing in a small village in Norway, population 1,000, milking cows while listening to Slipknot, discovering Metallica, meeting James Hetfield, and touring with Metallica for 8 months. So here it is, my conversation with Erland Hjelvik of Hjelvik. This is Speak and Destroy.
First time I like really discovered music was with Michael Jackson. Mm-hmm. When I was around 6 years old, I discovered his music videos with like Eddie Murphy in them and Macaulay Culkin, and I really liked those. That was like the first artist I was a real fan of was Michael Jackson. But that didn't make me want to be an artist or anything like that. But it made me interested in music, I think, and I started taking piano lessons when I was like 7 or 8, and then I had to learn music with like going through like a Beatles songbook, so it ruined Beatles for me for many years,
right?
Learning to play Beatles songs on the piano. And I guess it was when I discovered metal is when I really started wanting to like, that was when I started to want to perform myself and be a singer, was when I discovered metal. Like, I discovered Metallica first. That was, like, the first metal band I fell in love with, and then, like many people. Mm-hmm. And then I got into new metal bands like Slipknot and that kind of stuff, Limp Bizkit, whatever, and then getting into black metal later on, eventually. Like Dimmu Borgir and Immortal, those types of bands, and then it just kind of snowballed from there. So,
yeah. What was that first Metallica moment? What did you hear first? What did you see first?
Yeah, I think the first time I discovered them was probably through my brother, who's like 9 years older than me. I can't remember an exact moment, but he was just listening to like a lot of Metallica and grunge bands and stuff. And so that was just always kind of around, but it didn't like really click with me until like friends in school started listening to it. And then I just got exposed to it more. Like, I think Load and Reload, they were like the albums that all the boys in my class were listening to. And then it just, I started getting really into those albums, and then just kind of working my way back through the Black album, and then listening to Master of Puppets and Ride the Lightning and Kill 'Em All, working my way backwards. So, so I think I was like 12 years old when, at the time when I like discovered them for myself.
So. Yeah, and that's a conversation that comes up often about Metallica and other bands who are established and have a catalog is, you know, we all come in to the picture at various points of discovery, and it's nice when there's that you can reverse engineer, you know, everything that came before and the evolution of it and continue to discover things as you go back and further. And, you know, similar with filmmakers, I was speaking with a director a few days ago, and we got to talking about Quentin Tarantino, and he said that Kill Bill was actually the first Tarantino film that he saw. And I was, you know, on the one hand, you think, oh, wow, that's so late. But then on the other hand, you think, oh, man, but how exciting to go backwards and get to see all of those great films that preceded it and watch the evolution of, you know, a particular artist and their art. And, that's fun with Metallica also. The Garage Days EP was the current release when I discovered the band. Which, when think about it in retrospect, is a really strange way to come into a band. An EP as opposed to an album and all cover songs as opposed to originals. But that led me to Master of Puppets, and then I went backwards, and then a fan by the time And Justice for All was coming out. So, yeah, it's nice to have when a band has a rich catalog and a diverse catalog, because if you're coming in the Load Reload era, the Black Album's going to sound considerably different from those records. And then the further back you go, you know, it's just going to, you're going to see those leaps and evolution each stage of the way. I often liken it to going through a filmmaker's filmography, where, you know, you see The Shining for the first time, and then somebody's like, oh, you got to watch, 2001, and you got to watch, it's a really fun part of the adventure, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's a great feeling when you find something new you fall in love with, and then you discover, like, oh, there's tons more of this stuff. So then you have your work cut out for you just diving backwards into the catalog or whatever. So, yeah, I love it when that happens. I can't remember the last thing that happened for me now, but I agree.
Yeah, David Elveson put it really well when he was on the podcast. He said, we're all branches from the Metallica tree. And when you, look into, you expand outward from the Big Four and then all the thrash bands and all the various subgenres and things that have developed since, you know, Metallica is at the root of it. It is sort of the tree trunk, you know. You can go, oh, Megadeth was started by a guy that was a Metallica, and one of the guys from Slayer was in Megadeth, and it's just like it all unfurls, and you start to see this sort of tapestry that these bands and the subculture gives to us.
Yeah, it's crazy. I don't know if I would be into metal if I didn't discover Metallica first. So
right,
I'd be doing something totally different.
Yeah, they're kind of the quintessential gateway band for.
Yep.
Many people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is not only a cool place to be in and kind of an awesome responsibility, but something that they also, it's a certain power that they have, that they wield with a spectacular integrity and kindness, in so much as how they pay it forward to the bands who influence them and the bands who are coming up. Like when your old band was coming up, that they pay attention to, and whether it's Avenged Sevenfold or The Sword, at all different levels, they're constantly exposing their audience to other bands as opposed to this like tight protective, us, like they're very comfortable in their own skin enough to be able to share all these other bands with people.
Yeah, it's so cool that they're super nice guys, all of them. But I think that's like one of the great things that they do is like they're at that stature. They're the biggest band in the world. They wouldn't have to, they don't have to pay attention to any smaller bands, But It's really cool that they just kind of pay it. Is it pay it backwards or pay it forward? I
Pay
don't know.
it forward. Pay it forward.
Yeah,
Although
okay.
I feel like they pay it
Yeah,
backward
that
and
they pay it
forward.
forward and, you know, they help out younger bands and, you know, expose their fans to new types of bands that they probably never would have listened to if it wasn't for Metallica introducing it. Like, in our case, they brought us on a 8-month long tour and we got to play
Insane.
for, you know, crazy sized audiences, like audiences of like 20,000 people or whatever. So it's insane, but it's just so cool that they, yeah, bring a band like us that, you know, aren't particularly huge or anything, but yeah, they just you know, bring along the bands that they themselves personally like, and yeah, I think it's awesome that they gave us that chance.
So what was the evolution for you in going from becoming a fan of this stuff to then playing in bands? I mean, I often hear that learning piano, I wish I had learned it when I was young, but it's as much as kids hate piano lessons,
Yeah,
those
I
who grow
think
up to be musicians end up being really thankful that they have that foundation because it helps you understand so many other instruments and just songs in general. At what point did you, were you then able to turn your attention towards being in rock bands?
I think what made me want to sing for myself or scream is I think like listening to Sepultura, I think was like the first band that metal band that I discovered that was having these crazy types of vocals. And I saw the music video for Roots, and I just thought it was totally crazy, and it blew me away. And yeah, I guess that just kind of that aggression really spoke to me as a young teenager. And
Also
yeah,
big
then I guess
Metallica
what's
fans.
that?
Also big Metallica fans.
Yeah.
I've had Andreas on Speak and Destroy and Igor also. They've both been on.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, and then I got into like Slipknot was my favorite band for a few years, probably from when I was like 14 to 17 or something, and that made me want to start singing myself because, yeah, it seemed like really cathartic to me to just be screaming like that, and I was like really fascinated by it, and I wanted to learn how to do it myself, and that just, you know, it's a different feeling from just playing keyboards in a band, which I'd been doing before that. Like that wasn't totally doing it for me. So this was like a different way to be performing music, and I guess it just really spoke to me because I guess I just had a lot of built up aggression, I suppose, growing up in a small village in Norway. So I started practicing when I was working milking cows, which is the job I started doing when I was like 13, 14 years old.
That's incredible.
Yeah, so it was a good place to practice while I was milking them because it was pretty loud and I was working there by myself. So I did that, and then I started a band with a few friends in Vikedal, and actually the guitarist from Kvelertak, Bjarte, who I later started that band with, he joined in a few years later when I started high school to play drums. So I had that band before Kvelertak, and yeah, that's the first band that I was a singer in. So.
You know what's interesting is I love man, I love that visual of milking cows in the small village and being able to the cows as your captive audience, I guess,
Yeah,
hearing you
I
rehearse.
think they were louder than me, so I don't think they minded too much.
That's so great. Oh, that is so great. So what tell me, that makes me infinitely even more curious. Of course, in the States, metal fans in particular, we think of black metal as Norway's big cultural export to the world. My exposure to Norwegian culture as a kid growing up in the middle of America in Indiana was the band A-ha, who were
Oh yeah.
like my favorite band when I was in like sixth grade. To where, they're remembered as one-hit wonders here, but of course they've were much more successful around the world and continued to be. And I was one of the people here that got into them via the one hit, got that first album, but then continued to follow them and was like buying 12-inch remix singles and, you know, keeping up with their records after that. And what's funny is that I had an opportunity, and I always feel like I'm saying his name wrong, and I probably am, but Eason from Emperor.
Yeah.
I had an opportunity to interview him a couple years ago, and the first thing I brought up to him was Aha. Thinking that it was just going to be this sort of, you know, and he went into a long thing about how they're one of his favorite bands ever, and that there is a melody lifted from Aha hidden somewhere in Anthems to the Welkin at Dusk.
Oh, really?
and he challenged me to go and find it.
Yeah, I have to listen out for that next time.
Yeah, and then a year or two after I had that conversation with him, he actually released an Aha cover. This was just a few months ago, and I felt really in the know because I was like, I knew he was a fan. But
yeah, maybe you gave him the idea.
Oh, maybe. I hope.
Yeah.
But yeah, so with all of that, you know, very limited overview. Tell me about where you grew up specifically, and maybe how that. The remote nature of it, or the weather, or the isolation, the farm life, whatever it is that tends to lend itself to the kind of art and that comes out of there. You know, how did all of that shape who you are? What was that like?
Yeah. I grew up in a small village called Vikedal. It's on the southwest coast of Norway, and it's a pretty small town. Like there's 1,000 people living there. And
that is very small. There, that's like a Kill Switch Engage concert amount of people. You know what I mean? Like that's like less than.
So we moved there when I was 6 years old, and before that I'd been growing up in Holland, actually, in Rotterdam. My dad was working as a sailor's church priest down there, and then ended up moving back to Norway, and then he started working in Vikedal, and that's where, we stayed until, they still live there, and that's like my hometown.
Wow.
So, pretty small place, and really happy to have grown up there, like beautiful nature, fjords and mountains, and, you know, like I got to do stuff like work on the farm, which I was happy to have that experience, and like school was really good there because they were all like, I had like good creative teacher, and they were good at like letting you express yourself creatively. So it was like always a lot of music in school, and I was part of like marching bands and that kind of stuff. And yeah, so it was a good place to go to school too. And like, they were supportive of, you know, like that band I was telling you about that I started when I was like 14 or something like that. So they were supportive of that, and we got to practice in the school too, actually, just use it as a practice space. So
that's amazing.
Yeah, so that was great. Yeah.
So as a town of, you know, a village of 1,000 people, I know it's cliche to say, oh, everybody knows each other, but was that kind of your experience? Like, you, even if you don't know someone's name, you recognize their face everywhere you go?
Yeah, definitely. It's totally like that, where everyone knows who you are and the other way around. So yeah, it's pretty cozy, to put it that way.
Yeah.
Even though I might feel a little claustrophobic maybe, but it's, I think it's a good thing too. So
one thing that I'm always envious of, particularly when talking to metal musicians from any of the Nordic countries, any Scandinavia, you know, whether it's the guys in Inflames, is the music programs that exist in Scandinavia, education wise for kids. You know, I mean, like you said, not only it was encouraged where you were, and you were able to practice at your school. And I know a lot of the new wave of Swedish death metal bands started in high schools because it was like, that was their, you know, they had a class where it was like, here's our class, Forming Dark Tranquility or whatever. Like, I'm very envious of that, having grown up in an era and in a part of America that couldn't have been any further from that. You know, there was creativity was discouraged, and conformity was the
Yeah. You have to
MO,
figure
you
it out
know.
on your own.
You had to figure it out on your own, exactly. And very, very few teachers were going, oh, that's you know, that's an interesting T-shirt with a hand holding a bloody hammer that says "Kill 'em all." You know, there wasn't a whole lot of effort being made to understand anything outside of
Yeah.
the norm.
Well, I think it depends a lot on the type of teacher you get too, because there was definitely, I'm not saying it was all roses going to school either. Like, it had its bad sides too. Like, for example, we had like Christianity lessons, and it was just I remember that when I was like 7, and I was just reading to you straight from the Bible,
Wow.
which is, I didn't. Yeah, like, what are you supposed to do with that information when you're 7? Because it doesn't even make any sense when you just read it straight from the book.
Yeah.
So,
It really
yeah,
does.
so you
As an adult,
had that thing going
yeah.
on too at the time.
Wow. Yeah. I mean that. I
And
mean, you
I think
might as well
that's
read
probably that
Shakespeare
kind of
to a
stuff that
seven-year-old.
started black metal in the first place here. So.
Yeah. You may as well, play someone film in a language that you don't speak. That's a crazy style of indoctrination. Yeah, and as you said, that sort of makes you understand how black metal happens.
Yeah, I was a lot more conformist, I guess, like in the 90s. And yeah, I don't know. I was just, I think like the Norway was a lot more Christian of, like, that was the state religion back then. And I think a lot higher percentage of the people were like going to church, and that was like the main religion. And I think it was a lot more stifling, or that kind of environment at the time. So I can understand why black metal came around as a counter reaction to that.
Yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely. So, at what point did you become aware that Metallica was aware of your old band? Because
Yeah.
this was prior to playing shows with them and stuff, right?
Yeah. The first time I was aware of that was, we were on tour in America with Crawler Talk, and yeah, who were we on tour with? I think we were on tour with Torch, and I know I'm forgetting a band now, but a Torch were there at least, and we played in San Francisco at a place called Slim's, and I remember showing up there like early in the day and just checking out the venue and stuff when we were loading in. And there was a chef working there in the kitchen. He made really good food, like Mexican lasagna and that kind of stuff. And he was telling me that James Hetfield just called him and asked for a guest list. And I'm like, yeah, right. Like, he's just messing around or whatever. Because I didn't know the guy. And then I didn't think more of it. But like, that day was kind of lined up to be crazy to begin with, because they had approached us a few weeks prior to that about Crown Prince of Norway and his and the Crown Princess, his wife. They wanted to attend the show because they were doing, I don't know, some official business in America, and
Oh, wow.
he was a fan of our band, and he wanted to go see that show. So they made like arrangements, like his security team or whatever, to make sure, yeah, that was safe to go there and set things up. And like, before the show, we had the interview with the Norwegian state channel in the back alley behind Slim's. They rolled up in the limo, and we had to we had like an interview, and
Yeah.
we went.
And what are the customs with royalty? Because I know, the Queen of England, it's like, don't stand on this side, and don't, there's like customs that you're supposed to observe. Is that the case with Norwegian royalty, or is it more casual?
Yeah, the only thing I can think of is the addressing them in the third person, but I don't, they're not like the most formal people or royal family as far as royalty goes, I think. I think they're a lot more relaxed than probably other countries in the world, so I think that's cool. You know, they're going to a Kvelertak Talk concert, so it's yeah.
How traditional can they be at
No,
that
but
point?
so yeah, so my point is that like the evening was pretty bizarre to begin with, or like pretty overwhelming and weird.
Yeah.
Like just having an interview with them on the state channel, like before the show, and then yeah, so we did that for a while, and then we started playing the show. Like I don't know what happened in between there. It's all kind of like fuzzy to me now, like thinking back, but I just remember being on stage, like performing, and I look to the right and I see James Hetfield there, and he's just headbanging and really rocking out. And it's like, okay, this is just some weird dream that I'm in now. So that was, yeah, just like a crazy fever dream. It's really hard to describe because there were so many things happening at once, and Rob Flynn from Machine Head was there taking pictures too. So it's just like kind of like a strange overload of things happening. Yeah, it was a really, yeah, awesome show, and I just had a great time. And he was hanging out after the show, talking to us. So super nice guy, and he was, yeah, he put up with ha having everyone wanting to take pictures with him and that kind of stuff,
Sure.
us being totally fanboys. So that was awesome.
Yeah, that's killer. That's so killer. And then, do you remember much about the conversations you had, or I mean, questions you asked, or questions he asked, or?
No, I can't remember anymore. I know one of the guys in the band like videotaped him and made him say something about our band so we could use it for something. I don't think we did. But
Yeah,
it's
you're like, we
probably
may
good
never have
noise.
this
But
chance again. Yeah.
yeah,
Yeah.
I don't remember what I said to him either. I know I was being a horrible fanboy, and I was pretty drunk too from just yeah,
The
everything
day's
happening
events
earlier in
plus
the
the
day.
show. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a what? Yeah, what a crazy day. The Crown Prince and Princess, state TV,
Yeah.
and then
So that's what you can
Hetfield
call a
and
good day
Flynn
at
just
work.
hanging out. Yeah,
Yeah.
that's a crazy
So that
day.
was insane.
So then at what point did you learn, or and how did you learn that there was now an opportunity for you to go on tour with them? And was it presented originally as, hey, you're going to be doing like several months of this, or did that come in incremental stages, or how did all that
Yeah,
develop?
I might be remembering this wrong, but I know they wanted us to play the festival that they had.
Yeah, Rhine Festival, yeah.
Yeah. And we weren't able to do that because of other festival commitments and stuff. So a little bummed out about that. But luckily, later on, we got approached to do some Sonisphere festival shows with them, where they were headlining all the Sonisphere shows here in Europe. It was basically Metallica festivals, and
Yeah.
they were headlining, and we got to play with Children of Bodom and
Nice.
yeah, Alice in Chains, and who else was it? Yeah, those three bands and us.
Incredible.
And yeah, so we did like eight shows like that. So that was a really cool experience. That was, yeah. I can't remember which year, probably like 2014 or 15, I think. 2014, I would guess. And then, it's kind of hard to remember like the order of things happening, but I know I know James saw us at the Roskilde Festival too, and was like posting video of us performing, but I didn't get to talk to him that day because he had to run on stage right after we were playing, and then we had to leave like after watching just a few songs of theirs to go to the next show. But
Oh yeah,
well,
it looks like
anyway,
it was 2014.
yeah,
And
you're doing the research now.
I just pulled up one of the ad mats. I'm
Yeah,
trying
it's
to
good to have some
see
fact-checking while we're talking about this, because my memory is a little
in
fuzzy
real
at
time.
times, for sure.
Yeah, Metallica, Alice in Chains, Mastodon. Does that sound right? Or was that a different year?
Yeah.
That was 2014. That the headliners were Maiden One Night, was the Prodigy on Friday, Maiden on Saturday, and Metallica on Sunday.
Okay, that must be something else, but maybe it was...
Well, maybe they... Because I know they also did Sonosphere shows. That was when the Big Four shows happened.
We played with like Volbeat and stuff too, and I think that was like in Italy, and we played Poland and a bunch of places. So,
yeah, that could have been a. It's funny. I'm looking at AdMats now, and it's like here's Metallica headlining Sonosphere in 2011. So yeah, they've there were many years of Metallica and Sonosphere apparently.
Yeah.
Somewhere in there, we'll figure it out.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so Sonosphere shows were like the first. Kind of tour that we did with them, even though it was only, it was 8 shows, and then a couple years later,
it was 2014. Out, sorry, that was just a different one of the AdMets I was looking at was a Sonosphere date you guys didn't do, but the ones you did were 2014. I'm looking at one right now that's Metallica, Alice in Chains, Airborne.
Airborne too, right?
So yeah, okay. Sorry, go on. All right, yeah, mystery cool. Solved. We did it.
Yeah, good to know. Because I can't remember myself totally, like I said. So, yeah, and then we wound up doing their last big... no, it wasn't the last big European tour, but we did the first tour they did for Hardwire to Self-Destruct. Mm-hmm. So that was awesome. We got to... It's an 8-month-long tour divided into 4 parts. Huge tour, and... Yeah, that was really awesome. Just got treated really well. Like getting to play for 20,000 people every day and just the amazing facilities and crew being really great to us too. Like the Metallica crew were helping us get things set up properly on stage. And, you know, we get to have sound checks, that kind of stuff. It's, yeah, just really thankful to get that experience. And yeah, it was pretty crazy because they have that round stage, you know, mm-hmm. where you have people all around you. So that was kind of that's the first time I've experienced playing on a stage like that, where you kind of like have people around you, like you're in the Coliseum or something. But
and as a performer, you're having to figure out how to play to everyone, right, in the circle, as opposed to just kind of staring in one direction.
Yeah.
Did you find yourself moving around a lot? A lot more, yeah.
No, but I really started liking it eventually, even though at first I was really thrown off by it, because I have my thing that I've been doing for years, and, you know, you're used to facing the crowd straight on, and then suddenly you have people at all angles, but yeah, it's just really cool, and you get to move around a lot more, so I ended up really liking it.
That's awesome. So let's talk about each of the guys. Did you have an opportunity through the 8 months of touring? Because, you know, one thing a lot of fans don't necessarily understand is even when you tour with the band for that long, there's, you know, the schedules are different and things are hectic and travel and all of that. You don't necessarily get to see much of everyone all the time. But over the course of all that time, did you get a few interactions and experiences with each of the guys?
Oh, yeah. They were pretty good at, like... you know, they would invite us to dinners, and they would have parties once in a while, that kind of stuff. So it was really fun. Yeah, super nice guys. And, you know, like when we're having dinners, like they come and hang out with us. And, you know, it's crazy how many people are involved in that kind of tour. It's like, you know, I grew up in a village of 1,000 people, but there's like 2,000 people that's there every day working on this whole tour.
Yeah.
So it's like a village.
Basically.
But they were really awesome. And like, yeah, like I told you, having dinners and parties, and they come and spend time with you. And yeah, like we got to do interviews with Lars Ulrich has this podcast that he does. And got to be part of that. And lots of cool stuff that they do. So
very nice. I would imagine, you know, given your exit from the band and the timeline and everything there, I mean, are there as much of a great, amazing memory as the Metallica touring has to be? Is it also bittersweet? Is it mixed up with some, you know, less than awesome feelings, or
Yeah, sure. Like things aren't great with the band at that time, but like I just think about the cool stuff that happened, like great times hanging out with Metallica, and playing the shows were really amazing, even though off stage things weren't exactly perfect, but just playing the shows was still like a blast for me, and it's one of the coolest shows I've ever done, so I'm still I just think about the positive stuff when I look back at it, so.
Yeah, it's like a kind of a life lesson, right? Of things are difficult internally, but externally the greatest stuff is happening. So, like just the way that life can be, right? And look, the sweet and the sour at the same time.
Yeah, that's true. So, I don't know. I was just focusing on doing the shows the best I could, and so that was cool.
So let's talk about what you're up to, and let's talk about your current music and what's happening. And obviously everyone's had to adjust to how things are done and work gets done and things are presented and released and all that over the last year or so. But that aside, catch us up. Tell me what's on the horizon.
So I started a new band after I left Queller Talk. I started writing my own music, and I guess I had a couple of months off after I left my old band, and then I just slowly started getting the urge to make my own music and getting inspired, and then I started a solo band called Jelvik, and released my first album November last year. Should have been on tour right now, but for obvious reasons, that's not happening, which is okay. I guess it's, it is what it is. There's good things and bad things to, this whole COVID situation's to me anyway. So I'm just making the best of it, and did what I could at home from home, just promoting the album, and it's just been really busy with. Ever since the recording, just with the whole process of launching a new band and building websites and getting things set up and that kind of stuff, putting the album out, because in Norway my wife and I, we have our own record label too, so there's been some extra work involved with that, so it's been good to have some extra time, and not just because it would be a lot more stressful if we had to get ready for tour at the same time. But no, I'm really eager to start playing shows again, though. It's been weird that I haven't been on stage for 2.5 or 3 years now. So,
Yeah, that's crazy. So with Jelvik, when you have an opportunity to, take all of your past experience and figure out what you wanted to do, what you didn't want to do, what were some of your guiding principles as far as the kind of band that you wanted to have? Like what it should sound like, how it should come across, what you want to spend your time doing that makes you happy. What were some things that were essential to make sure the band had?
I didn't like really put forth a lot of rules for myself. I just wanted to make the music that I like. So that's, I'm a metalhead. That's like the one thing I just thought to myself is that it's gonna be metal. But I don't know if you listen to the album, but it's like inspired by like all the types of metal that I love, like everything from thrash metal to black metal to even some doom metal and 80s heavy metal. So all those influences are
All
in
things I
there.
love as well, particularly Doom. I think Doom is my favorite subgenre if I had to pick.
That's cool. Yeah, I really like Doom too. So I wanted all those things to like come through more clearly, I suppose. And yeah, it just felt really good just to write music just by myself. Like I've been part of writing music before in Killer Talk, but time I wrote everything by myself. And so that was just a really liberating process. And it was cool to find out that I could pull it off once I started working with recording software and, you know, using keyboards and guitars and then figuring, creating songs. And like the first song that I made was, Kveldulv, which is the eighth song on the album. And then the second song I made is Northstar. And then around that time, I just figured, okay, I'm going to make a whole album now. And that's how that band started.
You'd found your North Star, literally and figuratively.
Yeah, you could say that.
That's great. So I like to ask this of many guests. Yeah, well, as someone who plays a lot of instruments too, if you're warming up and you're just kind of messing around and Metallica starts to come out of your fingers, what's most common? What are go-tos that you're, you know, riffing around on?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would probably be something from Ride the Lightning era or Kill 'Em All, I think, if I'm making riffs or whatever. Like, on the album that I made, Welcome to Hell, there's the first song on the album is called Father War, and like after that big solo part in the middle, there's the part that really reminds me of Ride the Lightning. So it's just the bass and stuff. So yeah, I'm sure there's loads of other things I've kind of been inspired by Metallica by, even if it's on a more subconscious level too, maybe. But
so if you were to rank the Metallica albums in terms of your personal favorites, where would you put each of them next to each other?
Yeah, okay. So I would start with, I would put Master of Puppets number one and Ride the Lightning number two, Justice for All number three, Kill 'Em All number four, and Black Album number five. And really? I really like all the albums they put out. Maybe I didn't give Lulu a fair chance. I haven't really listened to it.
We don't have to count that one because it's that's a different band. It's Metallica plus Lou Reed.
Yeah, and whatever. It's cool that they experiment.
I think. I'm glad it exists, but it's not for me. But yeah, otherwise, I'm like you. Otherwise, I celebrate the whole catalog, and particularly Hardwired, I think is it's a really great sort of all encompassing. You know, some of the, you know, it's got the ferocity and the old school vibe that Death Magnetic resurrected, but then it also has a lot of the texture and the soul and the nuance that I think they explored in the 90s.
I agree.
It's a nice blend of their whole
I like that album a lot too, and especially like because we were touring with them, when they were playing mostly songs from that album. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the songs really sound awesome live. Halo on Fire. I remember I was one of my favorites of theirs when they played the live, and Atlas Rise and Spit Out the Bones, like just awesome, lots of awesome live tracks on it, and so that's really cool. I think it's a great album, so I'm pretty excited to see what they got in store next.
Oh, absolutely. And
the best thing about this COVID stuff is that you have all these albums coming out soon. Everyone's
so
working
many.
On albums.
Yeah, I manage a producer, and that's been one of the, there's a lot of a blessing and a curse about this whole situation, and that's been one of the things in his case. Like, he's been busy constantly because everyone's making records, so there's been no shortage of mixing to do and all that sort of stuff.
I think it's good for people to take a step back, and then, you know, like, personally, like, my creative juices really started flowing, or they started flowing after I, you know, left my old band and wasn't, like, like I wasn't in a band anymore, and then that really triggered my creativity. So I think this Corona stuff is doing the same for, most people when they're just kind of forced to isolate a little and just kind of be by themselves, kind of.
Absolutely. And I think, yeah, like anything, there's, of course, there's a horrific, tragic downside to the whole thing in terms of the loss of life and the economy and all of that. But there are many ways that you can find to thrive in this situation, whether it's recentering yourself or taking a step back forcibly. But still having to take a step back and catch your breath, there's definitely been an upside to that. And I think for creative people especially, because you don't have anything to do except either consume art or create art while you're holed up inside. So.
Yeah, so I'm, like I said, I'm really looking forward to all the albums that are gonna be coming out over the next year or two or whatever, maybe 3 years even.
Yeah. Have you thought about how you want to present the new band live? I mean, since you've had all this time to get ready in terms of what that'll look like in the live setting. Do you have ideas of
Right
that?
now it just feels like some weird fantasy to be talking about it because we're planning on doing a bunch of shows this summer, but now that's even looking kind of I'm skeptical of stuff
I am
happening
too,
this
and
summer.
every and I understand the inclination for folks to reschedule and postpone as opposed to cancel. But every time I see, oh, this tour got moved from here to here, I'm just like, I mean, can't we just say it's all on hold until we know what's up?
At this point, I don't want to do anything until I see someone successfully pull off a normal, decent tour. So, hopefully, next year that's going to be possible, I hope, or even this fall. But yeah, fingers crossed. But yeah, what I foresee from my live show, yeah, I have great guys in the band, so they're all gonna be part of playing the shows, of course. So I'm looking forward to playing live with them. Really great guitarists and great drummer and yeah, great bass player. So that's cool. Yeah, I just wanted to be like an awesome '80s heavy metal show. I'm sure you've seen pictures of me where I don't know, like I have a cape and stuff, and I just, I try to like the coolest bands that I personally like. That's bands that have like a whole package. I think, like black. That's probably a reason why I like black metal is because it's like also when it comes to cover art and what the guys in the band look like. It's just every piece is a. Fitting together, and it's it's I think like Ghost is a new band that's really successful of doing that too, and another great band, and yeah, same with Merciful Fate and King Diamond, of course, and yeah, so I just want my show to be like reminiscent of bands like that, and I want to have lots of pyro and smoke and atmosphere, so that's what I'm gonna go for. So I'll do my best to make it a show to remember.
I'm a big fan of theatricality and imagery and all of that, whether it's the Misfits and Samhain and Danzig, to, as you said, Merciful Fate, King Diamond, Ghost. I'm a big appreciator of that. And I'm like you, I think that that's, at the risk of sounding like a poser, I don't know that I would love, Transylvanian Hunger or Blaze in the Northern Skies as much as I do if the cover art wasn't so intrinsically tied to the vibe and the mysteriousness and coolness of it. It's not to say I only like it because of the cover, but that's definitely, it's the whole package. Like it all,
Yeah, I know. It's
it's a mood.
you eat, it's like with food, you eat with your eyes too. So I think it's exactly the same thing with music. I always end up comparing music to food whenever I talk about it. But yeah.
I back it. I'm a big fan of that also.
Yeah, it always works to compare it to some food analogy when you talk about music.
Yeah. Ever since you said Mexican lasagna, I've been hungry, so
Yeah, that sounds good. I'm hungry too.